So let's get into it here. He's risen. So yes, he is risen. It's not just that's just theory, but there are some people that think it's theory, and we're going to talk about that in just a little bit. But death couldn't hold him. Death could not hold Jesus, which is, we could have a whole day-long class just on that. You know, how is it that death couldn't hold him? But death could not hold Jesus because he was that perfect, because he was God. So let's talk about, first of all, I wanted to go over some of the theories. Our author in Prelude to Glory sort of as a sort of sub-thesis has a bit of apologetics in his narrative, and talking, you know, and wants to make sure that the reader knows that there's a lot of archaeological evidence and different evidences that make your faith real, make it all real, historical. So,
well, now, isn't it the only religion that's based on evidence? The only one.
That's what we're going to argue today.
Yes, sir.
Okay. Now, the swoon theory. I guess you probably all heard of the swoon theory. Can anyone tell me a little bit about this?
Just reply. Jesus really didn't know.
He wasn't. We have among us people that will purport that Jesus didn't actually die. He just kind of fell asleep and fell unconscious, and then he was later revived in the cool tomb. We're going to take a look at that cool tomb here in a minute, and it's probably was pretty cool in there. I used to sleep in the basement of the house. And man, I loved it down there. It was nice and cool all the time, you know. In a tomb, I'm sure it's quite cold and quite archaic. But let's just face it. Roman executioners were experts. They didn't make a mistake on a crucifixion. There's no way to make a mistake on a crucifixion. And if they did, they'd be the one crucified next, right? So they're not going to make any mistakes on crucifixions. And the interesting thing about the crucifixions is that apparently the Romans and the others that practiced crucifixion of the criminals, they didn't believe in burial at all. So when you were crucified, you were just left there to be eaten by the wild animals and insects, whatever. And there was no, decent burial after crucifixion. No, you were just left there to rot. And we're going to talk about that here just a little bit. So the spear thrust ensured that Jesus was dead. Now this is interesting. And one of the reasons I told you that story about my altar boy experience when I was a boy, the water and the wine, that's actually a medical thing. I did not know this, but apparently at death, your blood separates from the water in your body. And so this is a medical indication that Jesus was dead. Well, why is that important? Well, he was dead well before he should have been. One of the reasons execution was used by the Romans is because it was excruciating, long, painful death. It usually took about 3 days, 3 to 4 days, for you to die up there on the cross. There aren't very many in the hands and feet. They're blood vessels, but they're not the ones that make you die right away. So they're lighter blood vessels so you can live a long time on the cross. Especially on the type of cross that Jesus was crucified on. And the last thing is a severely wounded man, couldn't inspire people to a religion that spreads across the world. You know, that's not going to happen. Especially if he died shortly after that. So the swoon theory is kind of, it's easy to refute. Then there's the no burial theory. Jesus was never placed in a tomb at all. Instead, you know, this is actually recited, told to us in the scriptures that, you know, some thought that Jesus' apostles stole his body and took it someplace else just to mimic a resurrection. But there's a lot of independent sources that say that, that affirm the burial, and we have all the women that went to the tomb and went to the cross that affirmed the burial of Jesus. And then there's Jewish burial customs and a lot of archaeological evidence. I'll let you read the slide there. We won't go over it. We got a lot to go over here, so we'll get on with this. Then there's the no burial theory. Jesus was, his body was stolen. The accusation is actually told to us in Matthew 28:11-15. There was just a rumor. There's no basis in fact of that. The tomb was empty. The resurrection message was deliberate, a deliberate deception. That's not true. The disciples gained, they didn't gain any power or wealth or safety from, you know, why would they run out and tell a false story that, you know, most of the time when people lie, there's some sort of benefit for them. But they're not going to lie if there's no benefit for them. And then the explanation accounts it fails to explain the disciples' transformation or why the authorities never produced a body. So, okay, then there's the mass hallucination story. This is a really funny one. You know, everybody that saw Jesus after he rose from the dead, they were all hallucinating. Well, hallucinations don't happen in groups. So, so this, you know, early hostile witnesses are going to, are just going to say that Jesus was never raised from the dead, and that everybody was hallucinating. They didn't actually see Jesus. So, the encouragement we can all take from this is that the resurrection is not just a hope. It's a historical fact. One of the great things I love about the Bible, and I went to Father Fox after I became a Christian, and talked to Father Fox. He was sort of like the Kevin Knight of my group when I was growing up. And I told Father Fox, I said, you know, I became a Christian. He said, I really believe what the Bible has to say. And Father Fox said, well, Ken, the Bible is just a good book written by man. You know, we really have to follow the canon law. And that's when I knew I did the right thing.
Was he a Catholic?
Father Fox was a priest. He was a priest. He was wearing the white collar. But he was... He was one of those approachable priests, you know. He knew how to lead songs and stuff like that. You know, just like Kevin Knight. he was sort of my confidant as a youth in the Catholic youth group. Well, so let's talk about the death at Golgotha a little bit. I love this little graphic that's in the book. This comes right out of the book, Prelude to Glory. This is really cool. Right here you have the six trials of Jesus in the early morning hours from 6 to 9, and then the crucifixion from 9 to noon, and then look at this little dark quadrant right here. That's really cool because that shows the time when Jesus was when everything went dark for 3 hours. The tombs opened. This is really weird. It's just fascinating to me that, you know, they're unbelievers when tombs were opened of some of the faithful saints, and Jesus wasn't the only one that rose. You know, all these other people rose, then they died again. Only to die again at a different time. But that's kind of an interesting thing. But another interesting thing is that Caiaphas was a busy man. Caiaphas was a really, really busy man. He was busy running these six trials. Well, three of these trials. Three of these trials were before the Sanhedrin. to the religious leaders. And then three were before, you know, secular government officers, you know, Herod and Pilate. We all know those stories. But so there were, that's a lot of trials in 3 hours, right? Six trials in 3 hours. Illegal trials, you know, having a trial at night, which is against Jewish law. So that's interesting. Caiaphas pulled this all together. But you know, an interesting thing here is, and our author tells us in the two chapters that we're talking about here today, that Nicodemus and Joseph of Arimathea, both Sanhedrin members, were not included in the trials that morning. Why weren't they included in the trials that morning? Well, because they're pro-Jesus. You know, Joseph of Arimathea was converted. He was a Christian, you know? And Nicodemus too, right? So you know, Jesus died. You know, the Caiaphas and the Lamb. You know, Caiaphas would have been involved in the next day. The next day was Passover, and about high noon when Jesus was on the cross, and things went dark. That's when he was probably offering or leading the offering of the lambs at the temple. Isn't that ironic? So here's some pictures. This picture is from the book of the death of Golgotha. Here, this one on the left. And on the right, I went searching around for a more modern picture. This one's colorized. Here we see we have a transformer station, or you know, electrical transfer station here on top of Golgotha. And maybe a cell phone tower or something, I don't know. But that's what's up there now. But this is what they think is Golgotha. There's still a lot of debate about where Golgotha is. Well, some debate about where Golgotha really was. But I think this is, if you were to go over there today, this is probably where you would end up going. Notice the tour bus down here. So the morning sacrifice of Golgotha, what type of, Romans used a lot of different types of crosses. But from the descriptions that we have of Jesus' cross, we think, the author thinks that this is the one that is used for Jesus. This is the one that is typically put up in all your Catholic churches, this cross. And on your caskets, I have two or three three crosses from caskets at home, hanging on my walls, one from Dad and one from Eileen and another from my sister Helen. So I lost two sisters and my dad. So I have three crosses from three caskets, but three crucifixes. So anyway, this cross is probably what was used. Notice the weight of this thing. Good grief. It was probably made out of olive or oak. And just the crossbeam itself is probably about 75 to 100 pounds. Just the crossbeam. So, has anybody carried wood before? Yeah. Anybody carried wood before? You know, getting a 2x4 from my truck to the backyard, you know. Oh, I only want to do it once. You know, Jesus had to go a long way. We're gonna see later that he was toured all around the city, and then out the Damascus Gate, and about 250 yards up to Golgotha Hill. That's a long way. I sure hope they gave him a rope to pull that thing, and I sure hope all they made him carry was his crossbeam. You know, but. I don't know. We don't know. I'm not sure if there's any certainty as to how much. You know, if he had to carry this whole thing, the whole thing is almost 200 pounds. That's a lot. That's a lot of weight. You know? I hate to say it, but I'm almost 200 pounds. Anyone want to try and pick me up? I'll carry you that far? Carry me 250 yards. Yeah. So here we go. Here's the way. Now Jesus was issued the cross at the fortress of Antonia. They were in the corner of the city, as you can see. Then he went along the Via Dolorosa that we've all heard about. And then out the northern gate of the Damascus gate, the northern gate of the city, and then up to Golgotha Hill. The garden tomb was very close. The Bible tells us the garden tomb was very, very close to where Jesus was crucified. I've heard it's a 5-minute walk. That's what I've heard. It's a 5-minute walk from Golgotha Hill to the presumed garden tomb. Now, the Church of the Holy Sepulchre there, that you see here in the middle here, has long been held as the traditional, you know, Golgotha Hill and burial site of Jesus as well. So, so anyway, there's not a lot of, there's not total certainty as to the sites, but if you were to go over there today, this is kind of what you would see. These pictures also came from the book. So that's an old picture of the Damascus Gate. I'm sure it looks a lot different today. The book is, when was the book written? You know, I don't remember. Ken's going to look it up for us. So that's a long, long way. Carry 200 pounds or 100 pounds, either one.
1987.
Old pictures. Pretty old pictures. That would put them about 39 years old. Yeah, it probably looks a little different today. So, then we have the dividing of Jesus' garments by the soldiers. I just wanted to ask a question at this point. What detail of the crucifixion story stands out to you the most? Anybody want to?
Well, none of those. I've always been curious on why he did not drink the sour wine. Was that a regular practice, like painkiller?
Well, the sour wine, I think if it had myrrh in it, it would have been apparent. The first one that he was offered with myrrh in it would have probably been a painkiller. But the sour wine was just, my understanding was like cheap wine that the soldiers drank just to refresh themselves. And so it was really just a refreshment, I think. Not sure why he took it. Does anyone want to speculate as to why he took took it the second time, but the first time he denied it? And then the first time he denied it, the scholars commonly think that the first time he denied it was because the myrrh was in there, and there didn't want to be any suggestion of pain relief, you know, from the first drink. You know, second drink, there's no pain reliever in there. So
he wanted to be fully conscious,
right?
With the bio of the author suspects,
right? Fully conscious, exactly right. So anyone want to speculate as to why he took the second drink?
Thirsty.
Yeah, that's my guess. He's just thirsty. And there was no nothing prophetical, I guess, about the second drink. You know, that's what I want to say. Anyway, so they divided his lots. They divided his garments into four parts. So the inscription above the cross, we got, in the four different Gospels, we have some variation in what was above the cross. But generally speaking, this is Jesus of the Nazareth, the King of the Jews, was what they inscribed above the cross. That seems pretty long to me. if I were a lazy Roman soldier, I think I'd do something more like King of the Jews, something like that. But I think the authors of our Gospels were just trying to give us an idea of what was above the cross. not necessarily the exact wording. Okay, so again, in the first 3 hours, Luke describes lots of mocking from the public. Well, if you're Jesus, you know, if you're the Christ, why don't you take yourself down and save yourself? Save us too. And then the two thieves on the cross, same similar things, and all of this is going on, and for the first 3 hours, a lot of suffering, a lot of endurance of mocking. And then at the 12th hour, sixth hour. Now, one of the great things about this graphic too, it shows you there were two different systems of time. There was the Jewish system of time, which started at 6 o'clock in the morning. So it would be the sixth hour in Jewish time. Noon would be the sixth hour in Jewish time. In Roman time, it was the 12th hour. You gonna say something, Tim?
No.
Oh. Now this is important to know because we have a variation in the description of the timing of things from the Synoptic Gospels and John's description of the timing of the events is a little bit different, and the thought is that John was using Roman time instead of Jewish time, but most of our Gospel authors used Jewish time. So at 12 o'clock, Jesus says, "Woman, behold thy son." "Woman, behold thy son," and to the disciple, "Here is your mother." And from that time on, this disciple took him into her home. Now, John probably must have lived nearby, and so I think Jesus and Mary, or John and Mary, lived in Jerusalem there until he passed away. So at the sixth hour, this is interesting because things go really dark at the sixth hour, and they're dark until the ninth hour of the day, or 3 o'clock in Roman time, in our time, and that's why you have the dark quadrant there. You know, a lot of your skeptics will try to describe this as an eclipse. But anyone that knows, but science will refute that. There's no way it could have been an eclipse. Eclipses don't last 3 hours, for one thing. There was a full moon. Passover always happened on a full moon, and for some reason, the full moon prevents an eclipse. So I don't know all the astronomical reasons for that, but it's simple enough for me. No eclipse lasts 3 hours. There's no way. And things, you know, you don't have Earth, you know, you don't have crazy things going on either, like tombs opening up and people walk around. You know. So, the second 3 hours. So, let's talk about that. We've got darkness covers the land. We've got this all in all our Gospels. And then here we have that saying from Jesus. Jesus says his final words during this period were, "I thirst."
Yeah. But then he died right after that.
And it's finished. Then it's finished, and then his death.
Do you think maybe, you know, when he said "I thirst," it was having a problem speaking, and so the liquid allowed him to announce it is finished, clear?
I think that's plausible, for sure. Yeah. I sure do think that's plausible.
Yeah, "I thirst." It is finished. So what was finished?
God's plan.
What is life on earth, or his physical life? Well, no, because he was resurrected. And part of his plan, because he had to be raised, he came back. Those 100 people that rose from the grave.
Excuse me, I'm not crying. I just have this terrible dry eye thing. I call it wet eye. But
his death was finished.
It is finished. The atonement.
That was required.
That's the word I was looking for.
Yeah, that's good.
The atonement was finished.
He just bore the sins of every human.
The atonement was finished. So, you know, during those dark 3 hours, one of our creeds talked about Jesus going into hell and all kinds of things. I don't know what happened exactly during those 3 hours, those dark 3 hours, the thing that we need to focus on is those words right there. It's finished. The atonement is finished. That's where we get our salvation from, right there. Happened at 3 o'clock on Passover Day, long ago. So, the sacrifice, Jesus was the sacrificial lamb, the last sacrificial lamb that we need. Jesus cries out. So, we have, at that moment in time, earthquakes happen. A big earthquake happens. The rocks split. Tombs are opened. And then we have centurion is terrified and confused. And the tearing of the veil.
Yeah, tearing of the veil. Do you have anything else to say about that?
The tearing of the veil. What does that represent?
Gentiles and Jews, everyone's accepted. He's not hidden.
You don't have to go to the priest anymore.
Close, but not exactly. go ahead. Anybody else want to speculate as to what our author says? I'll tell you what our author says.
He represents access.
Access. Good. Oh, well, access is good. Yeah, that's good. Before this, only the priest could go into the Holy of Holies. Could go behind the veil. Only the priest, only the high priest, could go behind the Holy of the veil. Now we all can go behind the veil. We can enter the Holy of Holies because Jesus has given us that opportunity. We just need to take advantage of that. We can enter the Holy of Holies. And pray and talk to God and beseech God and walk with God and try to understand mankind. all of these things we can now do that we couldn't do before this, because Jesus was the final lamb sacrificed for our salvation. So let's talk about now the burial. The breaking of the prisoner's legs. Now, and we also were going to get into a little bit about the timing of Easter and those kinds of things. And, so in the New International Version, we read, "Now it was the day of preparation, and the next day was to be a special Sabbath." Now that's important. Remember those words, special Sabbath. Because the Jewish leaders did not want the bodies left on the crosses during the Sabbath. Jewish leaders believed in a decent burial, even for criminals, And so they were successful in convincing the political leadership at the time that this needed to be done. And so Pilate was, this was not a battle he wanted to fight. Pilate did not want to fight this battle. He needed some buy-in from the people he was ruling. And so this was an easy one. Okay, you want to bury people? Go ahead. So he just allowed it.
Did they always bury people?
For political reasons.
But when they got stoned, they bury those people too?
I have to defer on that one. I don't know. But I'm sure the Jewish people did. I'm guessing they did. Yeah. Well, they didn't want these bodies left on the crosses during Passover. So that's why they implored Pilate to, let's take down the bodies and bury it. And we just don't want them on the crosses. you know, during the Sabbath. So Pilate let him do that for political reasons again. And so in order to do that, they have to be dead. So he break their legs so that they can, so that they can't use that footstep to push themselves up. The reason that was there is so that the prisoner, the person being crucified, could push themselves up to prevent suffocation. Because without that, they just hanging there would make them suffocate, and they would die really, really fast. So they didn't want them to die really fast, so they gave them a footstep so that they could prolong the death. But by breaking their legs, you can't use the footstep anymore, so you suffocate to death really, really fast. So that's why they did that. But when they got to Jesus, Jesus was already dead. Now this is important too. So Jesus explicitly states that his death was voluntary. We didn't take anything from Jesus. We didn't take anything from Jesus. He gave us his life. He laid down his life. He didn't die because of the crucifixion. He laid it down. That's why he was already dead. He laid it down. And he can take it up again at will. So that's just the basics of God. I can lay down my life and I can take it up again. So this is important, I think, for all of us to know that Jesus loved us enough to lay down his life. He laid it down. It wasn't taken from him. We didn't take anything from him. And so this is an important thing to know about the cross that I don't think I learned when I was growing up in the Catholic Church. That because in a Catholic Church, I think the cross is supposed to make you feel guilty that you took something from God. You know? And that's why it's up there. It's so prominent. You know? You got to feel guilty that you took something from God and change your behavior. No, you don't feel guilty. You don't feel guilty. Jesus gave it up on his own. This was an achievement. This is an achievement. And it's a great achievement on our behalf. So the burial events. Joseph Arimathea carried the cross for Jesus part of the way, and then he gave him his tomb. We're going to talk about the rich man's tomb and the poor man's tomb here in a minute. Joseph of Arimathea and Joe and Nick. How do you like my nicknames? Joe and Nick, the upper class Sanhedrin members. That's what SM stands for. They were Sanhedrin members. They were probably excluded from the morning trial because they were pro-Jesus. And Caiaphas knew this, and so that's why he needed a unanimous vote that there was blasphemy and other things so they could get Jesus crucified because he hated him that much. So Joseph was, you know, highly respected council member, and he asked Jesus, Pilate, for Jesus' body, and that's when Pilate's really surprised. What? Yeah, already? You know, because Joseph was already asking him for Jesus' body, but he was really surprised to hear that. So he had to get centurion verification of that, and so he did. And of course, Jesus' body was given to Joseph, and Nicodemus helped a lot with the burial too. And so the four Gospels kind of agree on that. So the preparations for Jesus' burial. Wow. You know, normally a burial of this type took weeks, you know. If you got bathing the body done on the first day, you were lucky, you know. They had Jesus packed in spices and wrapped around in a shroud in an hour. Or two. Or three.
So one thing I think that's really interesting about this set of events right here is that obviously it's Passover time, And so the fact that Joseph took Jesus' body down off the cross meant he was no longer able to participate in Passover because he was unclean.
Right. Okay. Good point. That's true. That's true. He was unclean after doing that. And so that was...
You made all these tables?
No, AI did. I have to confess.
It looks like a lot of hours.
AI is a lot of help when it comes to something like this. So, it's a good thing in some regards, and in this regard, it's pretty cool. So if you like these slides, I'm glad to give them to you. There's the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, where which is what you would... The tourist attraction in Jerusalem now. As we're going to see, this garden tomb was sort of lost for a period of time. In the mid-1800s, they found it. They found this tomb that they think more accurately fits the description of the garden tomb in the scriptures. And it's close by Golgotha. So this might be a site that you would tour if you were to go to Jerusalem. Those pictures don't look at all alike to me, but these are the pictures that I was... This one came from the book. Did it? No, I don't think this one came from the book either. Which one came from the book? This one came from the book. This one came from the book. This is the picture that you can see it above. Now, I could see a stone being rolled in front of this door kind of easily. On the other hand, might be a little easier to roll a stone in front of a little hole like that or that. we always see this big round stone in the graphics that we have of Jesus, but it was probably some boulder, just a big boulder that was put in front of a hole like that. So let's take a look at what a tomb might have looked like. Tombs of a poor man, these are from the book. A poor man's tomb was more of a communal burial site. You know, there were a lot of different tunnels in there, and you would just, they were basically tunnels, that's what I like. And you slide the body in and out of there. I don't know how they did that. A lot of friction and all that, but I don't know. Somehow they did it. Maybe with wood pallets or something like that. But the rich man's tomb is more like the description we get from the scriptures. Is probably what Joseph of Arimathea's tomb probably looked like. There was a mourning area there, and then there was the two. In this case, there were only two ledges, probably for him and his wife, and Joseph of Arimathea was giving up his spot. He spent a lot of money to have this hewn out of the rock for he and his wife, but he was giving it up for Jesus. So a nice gesture, of course, was only temporary, I think. But he didn't know that was going to happen. I'm not sure if he knew that was going to happen, but that's what we—that's kind of what we think the author thinks those look like. So, the women in our story are very key. Very key. Why? Because women were, second-class citizens. They were. I guess that's the right way to say it. I'm trying to be politically correct too, but they weren't politically correct then. So they're kind of second class citizens, and they just, weren't believable by, men didn't want to believe anything that women said, And so the fact that we have Mary Magdalene and other women witnessing the burial of Christ, and then later on the resurrection, they didn't witness the resurrection, but they found Jesus resurrected, and the tomb and the stone rolled away. These stories from women are more credible because of their status at that time. Their status at the time is what makes their stories credible. So it's interesting that God used this weakness of man to create history that we could rely on, that we could anchor our faith in. I really find it fascinating. God thought of everything. Thought of everything. Everything. So here's some pictures that I found, that, you know, the women at the tomb. So let's just read that. The women witnesses are one of the strongest historical anchors for the authenticity of Jesus' death, burial, and resurrection. In the first century, Jewish and Greco-Roman world, their presence is the sentimental detail. It's not just a sentimental detail, it's an embarrassing, counterproductive, and therefore highly credible feature of the gospel accounts. Because no one inventing a resurrection story in the first century would ever choose women as the first and primary witnesses. Their presence is a historical fingerprint of authenticity. Let's talk a little bit about the sealing of the tomb. This is the last thing that our author talks about, those two chapters that we're dealing with today. It was tight. The tomb was sealed up tight, nice and tight, and then guarded by the Roman officers. At one point, the Roman officers were bribed, and they were asked to say that they fell asleep. And disciples came and stole the body. But no Roman officer is going to do that. He was, very few, take a bribe like that, because it's death. It's death if you do that. So the Roman guards, the fact that Jesus got by the Roman guards, the fact that he got by the rock, all this adds credibility to our historical story of the resurrection of Christ. So, what emotion do you imagine the women at the cross were feeling?
Shock, heartbroken.
Shock and heartbreak?
Yeah.
You're talking about at the burial or at the empty tomb?
No, I can't get into the empty tomb yet. That's next week. We're talking about at the burial.
Obviously, then a lot of grief and sorrow.
Well, they were with him through most of his ministry, 3 years. They loved him. You can imagine them, how emotional they were. The disciples, I think, was a little bit different. They saw him as the coming Messiah who was going to restore the kingdom of David, a physical kingdom. And like before, throwing off the bonds of Egypt, he was supposed to throw off the bonds of Roman rulership. So I think their thinking was a little bit different. At least the author brings that out anyway.
I think that's exactly right. I think their feelings of sorrow. And the reason I ask that question is because, I got a lot of family that are Catholics, I was driving. I worked at Hewlett Packard when I was in college and as a summer job, and I was my cousin did too. She had a full time job there. I just had a part time job, summer job. And so we're driving to work one day, carpooling to work today, to Hewlett Packard out there on Garden of God's, used to be on Garden of God's Road over there. And she says to me, Kenny, I'm sure that I think I'm good enough. You know, everything will be fine. God's gonna, you know, I don't feel uncomfortable at all. You know, I'm good enough. But you know, the question is, see, Catholics don't do. They compare themselves. What Catholics tend to do is they compare themselves to the other guy. You know, and it's usually the serial killer. I'm a serial killer. I'm gonna make it to heaven. You know, but what you need to compare yourself to is Christ. And if you compare yourself to Christ, this is you, this is Christ, can't win.
Got to take the log out of your own eye.
And we as Catholics, you know, I think they get stuck right here at the tomb. Feeling like something was taken from God, you know? Nothing was taken from God. God laid it down. It was all voluntary, you know? It was all voluntary. God gave his life. Jesus gave his life for us. So we don't want to get stuck at the tomb. We want to... But even though atonement happened on the cross, right? So that point... Where Jesus said it is finished. That was it. That's what he meant. It's finished. It's finished. You're saved. You're saved. You're saved. Everybody, you know, if you've accepted Christ, you were saved at that point. You know? It kind of makes you wonder what the resurrection was for. Well, we're going to talk about that next week. Because it's not what happened on the cross. All right, that's all I have for you today. Any questions?
Hey, Ken.
Hey, sure. Ken.
Awesome. If I could go back to the "it is finished" comment. You know, at the beginning of the crucifixion, Jesus said, my God, why have you forsaken me? And that's a quote from Psalm 22.
Right.
If you look at the last verse of Psalm 22, it says, he has done it. But you could... translated saying it is finished. And what did he do? He proclaimed his righteousness from Psalm 22. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I really appreciate that. I look at the cross so much differently than I used to when I and now when I see it, it's just you know, I look at it as a symbol of victory, not as something to be sorrowful about. But yeah, thank you for that, Rick. Yeah. Any other questions? All right, let's go worship the Lord.